Namaste. Last time we spoke about the gods and how they are not just concessions given to human nature to have plurality of approach, but actual powers and aspects of the one. And also because the one is Sachidanand, we have these first four gods. We have Sat, existence, we have consciousness in its dual aspect of knowledge and force. And we have Ananda. So these are the first four gods, and out of whom many subsequent gods, like rays of the sun streaming down into creation. That's how there is a whole network of gods. We can compare it to this way, that if we go close to the sun, now there will be a tremendous intensity. So the great gods are like that. Sri Aurobindo describes them in Savitri, where he says they are absolutely, they don't respond to virtue, vice, our tears, absolutely nothing. So they act only under the impulsion of the divine. So that is our greatest gods. They don't care about what human beings go through, because they have no idea of what we go through. But then as the same ray, the same intensity, by the time it reaches the earth, it undergoes a modification. So it is this successive modification that leads to the working of the gods here. This is the first thing. Second thing, that these gods are at once psychological as well as working in the inanimate world. So very often we'll see that praying to stone. So there is the sun god, and sun god is shown as the physical sun. And there are rain god, Parjanya, Varun. So they call it the rain god. Indra is the thunderstorm. So this is Marut says actual wind. So there has been an interpretation along these lines that, they didn't know. The ancient people, like many primitive races, they didn't know about the actual things, that this wind is not a god. It is just wind. And you need to understand it scientifically. So they used to pray to the wind. But it's not exactly like that. In fact, based on the singularity of plan, they saw simultaneously the working of the gods in the physical and the non-material psychological world. So sun was at once the physical sun, which gives warmth and light and everything. But sun is also the divine consciousness, that aspect which gives illumination. So illumination is not just a physical thing, it is also at once psychological. Usha sees the morning sun as well as sees the bringer of illumination. The sun, he is the fosterer. So when we look at the Isha Upanishad, for example, so sun is described in so many terms, fosterer, nourisher. Similarly, we see Agni. Agni is not just, sun is also the ordainer of the law, because it's around the sun, and based on that, all the planets are, moving around in the fixed orbits. Similarly, we see Agni. There is the physical Agni. And the beauty is there is a correspondence. So there is a physical Agni. What does it do? It burns, number one. So by burning, it destroys. And what does it do? It also absorbs back within itself, because it destroys means what? It converts matter into its original form, which is energy. At the same time, what cannot be destroyed, it purifies. So the psychological functions of Agni as God are equally the purifier. So what does Agni do? It destroys what needs to be destroyed. Something which has become OTO, something which has become redundant. It is also described as the leader. It's the Purohit of the march. So what does it do? It leads and destroys things which need to be destroyed to clear the path. And then we see that many of these gods whose stories in the form of legends, they come so well, like Kartike. Kartike is the son of Shiva and Parvati. And who is Kartike? He is Devasenapati. Now, how does Devasena word comes? Actually, his wife's name is Devasena. But at the same time, he is the leader of the army of the gods. Now look how beautifully it is designed. So he is the Devasenapati. Why is the Devasenapati? He represents the Agni. So he is that power which clears, it removes everything. It destroys what needs to be consumed. So Agni is the leader of the march. He is the one who will first go. Whereas Agni itself is born from Vayu. So people who don't understand it this way, they get pretty confused that who is the God whom actually we should worship. You will see in one set of verses, it is Agni. Why? Because Agni is the leader of the march. Agni is the one who will clear the path. But if you see from the point of view of the emergence, then you will see that the Vayu Tattva has come first and then comes Agni. So one has to understand this entire thing, and even in one's own body we can see the functioning of the gods. So for example, we have the physical matter, which is the prithvi element. Now just before prithvi is jalam. Now look at the body, where is all the functions of literally things which are jalam, you know, which are whether you take as, you know, the fluid accumulation and all that, is primarily this area which is just above the, you know, around the Swadhisthan. Then you have, above that is Agni. This is the seed, digestion, and behind it the dynamic will, the heart, impulsion of all that. Then you have the Vayu Tattu. Where is the Vayu Tattu? You have the lungs and the Maruts, the speech. This is where the Vayu Tattu is there. And then you have the Akash, the ether, which is in the brain, which is the organ, which can. So everywhere you have the same planning. So we can apply it. Now, how we can apply it? It's very interesting. If you take only the material application, then you will study a, you know, herb or whatever, and you'll say it has more of Agni Tattva in it. So wherever there is a problem where there is a weak digestion because the Agni Tattva is missing, you take that medicine to increase the Agni Tattva. This was the original sense. Now, if there is phlegm here, more of the kapha, the vat pitta kapha. So you take things which actually increase the Vayu element so that it goes away, vat element, because vat has diminished. So this was a very subtle way of looking at things. But equally, instead of the material thing, you could invoke the deity behind it. People think that, you know, praying to gods, because everything can be seen as impersonal, as force, but everything can be seen as existence or personal. They are always together. So if we look at us as a function, then we can say that, you know, there is an impersonal side in everyone. But if we look at ourselves as a person, so we have the person and the personality, which is the functioning. So everything in this creation has an impersonal side, which is force. Similarly, it has a personal side. Let's take an example of love. Love is impersonal, like any other force. But is love only impersonal? No, it is also personal. It can take a personal form. So it's true of every knowledge. Is it personal or impersonal? It has an impersonal side. But in its application, it becomes very personal. So you have knowledge of this, you have knowledge of that, you have knowledge of, you know, 100 ways of applying it. So the gods in the ancient Vedic system, they invoke the gods as persons whose personalities would come and actually help the human body. For example, there were Ribhus, artisans of immortality. There were the Maruts who came and cleared the wherever there is vat, you know, for certain function. There were the Ashwin Kumars who would come and create the sense of balance and youthfulness, vigor and energy. There was the sun who could destroy all the other, all the doshas and put them into the right balance. So they are at once, we can regard them as personal deities. We can regard them as material objects in which the gods are functioning. We can regard them purely as psychological forces. So we use now, because human mind is functions in a secular way, which is all right, modern way. So now, whether we worship Durga or not, we cannot deny the fact that a woman can become Durga. We actually use it. There have been, you know, certain stories like that, that, you know, she was like a Durga, veritable Durga. Similarly, when it is said that there is the Singha of Durga. Now, what is Singha? Singha is quiet power, mass of strength, something which can spread terror in the enemy ranks. But equally, this Singha can be seen actually in the subtle vision as the, because she takes that form, that power in Durga, which is a mass of strength before which the demons are terror struck, takes the form of an actual lion on which she is seated. But in the physical world also, lion has a similar function. So at every level, the same truth applies. So there are countless gods which are functioning in this universe. They are in, you know, every system in the human body can be attributed to one god or the other. And they all can be traced upwards to the main god. For instance, the workings of the human body itself. So who is the main god behind it, or the goddess? It is Mahasaraswati. What a detailed working and perfection. Then similarly, all the play of love in this creation, whom do you trace it to? Mahalakshmi. You see, there is a picture of the mother sitting with dogs, and she says, this one I like very much. This is my most favorite aspect. This is Mahalakshmi. And she says she is very fond of animals and plants and all creation. So wherever you see in human beings that they are very fond of, you know, all this, you can either look at equality, oh, this person is so loving and caring about animals, or you can say manifestation of Mahalakshmi. The person may not know, but you can actually see it. Similarly, where there is wideness, calm, intelligence, it is Maheshwari. That's how we have the vibhutis. Wherever there is strength, the frontal stroke, wherever there is a Shivaji, wherever there is a, you know, Baji Prabhu, wherever there is a Tanaji, wherever there is a Maharana Pratap, wherever there are those heroes who have jumped into the battlefield, regardless of death, and their action have changed entirely the whole battle. Equally, wherever there is a child who is so truthful to a default that he shakes the very foundation of the adult world, there is Mahakali. That's why Sri Aurobindo very beautifully, I mean, we all do a reading of the mother. How, see, these gods have also evolved over a period of time in the human consciousness. So you will see that initially in the far back times, pre-Vedic times, you see them largely performing a material function. Then in the Puranas, you see they become already more and more psychological. Now Sri Aurobindo gives them an entirely, completely new vision and understanding. So how do we pray, let us say, to Mahasaraswati or to Maheshwari? If you have to pray to Maheshwari. Now if you go to the traditional approach, you have to pray, you know, people won't even know who is Maheshwari, the only place you will find a mention is Chandi part, where, you know, it is more of Maheshwara, but the feminine energy. So what you do is, you do the Chandi part, and, you know, if there is ever a place dedicated, ever thought why there is no temple of Maheshwari, though sometimes people regard her as Shiva's consort. So how do you pray to her? They will say, okay, Kali likes this flower, Durga likes this flower, and, you know, Mahalakshmi, you pray in this way, Mahasaraswati, you pray in this way. But when, if you read through Sri Aurobindo's The Mother, so what is the way? Maheshwari, who is she? Wide, calm, impartial. Partiality she has none, but she knows the right law of everything. Anyone who can ascend to that state of wideness, stay calm, tranquil, deal with men, events, forces according to their own unique law, is a vibhuti of Maheshwari. He may be in India, believes in Maheshwari, he may be in America, who doesn't believe in any of the gods, yet he is what he is because of the function of the gods. Similarly with Mahakali. How to worship Mahakali? All the impulses that are straight and swift and frank, truthful, honest, sincere, they are coming from Mahakali. Similarly with Mahalakshmi. All the love which harmonizes rather than divides, love which is beautiful, where there is none of those elements of jealousies and, you know, possessiveness, all the lower elements, all that makes love ugly and, you know, debases it, then Mahalakshmi withdraws. Otherwise, Mahalakshmi will manifest herself. Sri Aurobindo says that Lord Rama, one of the aspects very prominent in him was Mahalakshmi. That's why he could harmonize everyone, in spite of being a warrior. And then, of course, Mahasaraswati. Whenever we, play with tools, whenever we, in the details of everything, when we go into it so beautifully, putting everything, not only in physical world, but psychologically also, we put everything in the right order, in the right way, in the right arrangement, keep everything in its proper place, proper organization, that is dear to Mahasaraswati. So if we really read the mother, we see that the great goddesses, he has given them a new way to look at, he has given us a new way to look at them and a new approach towards them. So we don't have to pray in a temple, but we have to do the things that the goddess loves. And if we do it, she will come. Mother says at one place, you know, when people talk about worship, at one place he says, do you think any divine being really likes it? Just imagine, you know, she says, divine beings, what do they like? They like a beautiful, noble gesture. Outwardly, we cannot see it, but divine beings take note of it because they are right behind, observing even the smallest details. Outwardly, we may not know what happened, but inside, they are observing and they are taking note of it. And that's what ultimately counts, that little inner movement. So these divine beings, gods, they are realities. They are actually functioning in every detail of our body, our being, our psychological apparatus, in the whole cosmos and creation. And there are many truths we can derive from it. We can actually derive psychological functioning vis-a-vis material forces, because there is a correspondence. I mean, because it's the same God which has become that fire, and the same God which has become the fire within us, the fire of aspiration. So take, for example, if you light up a fire, what happens with when you light up a fire? One of the things people do, it is unique to human beings. Isn't it? Only human beings can light a fire. So what is unique about human beings? This aspiration. It marks our humanity. If we have no aspiration, we are as good as animals. We don't have horns, we don't have a tail, we don't have... But without aspiration, the humanity has not yet graduated from its animal state to the human state. Similarly, see the symbols, how they work. There is a truth behind it. What happens when the fire is lit up? There is... Animals go away at night to light up the fire. When there is ignorance, light up the fire. And if you light up the fire, animal states of consciousness before this fire of aspiration will stay away. Then you light up the inner fire and offer things inside. This is the inner yagna. But you can light up the fire outside and offer things outside. But provided you do it with that understanding, that because it supports, it's the same thing like doing with the beads when we do mala. Real mala is inside, but it's difficult for some people. So they use a material medium to count. Similarly, we can light up a fire outside and it will have its own effect. But the real power will come from the inner state with which we are approaching it. So we can see there is a singularity of plan in which the gods operate, their cosmic powers. And these gods, right up to in India, you know, you can start... Initially, threefold function, 3 into 30 into 300, 3000, ultimately 33 crore. 33 crores. Why it comes, this figure comes? Because every small functioning. You see, if you go back to the ancient times, now we don't have, we have different approach, Corona and all this, but earlier there used to be a goddess called Shitla Mata. So when people used to have pox, they would go and pray to Shitla Mata. Who is Shitla Mata? She's the being. As I said, you can look at it as a force, try to understand, master the force, analyze the force, or you can look at it as the being. So if you have the being, in some way to have a power over the being, then it's a different science altogether. So how was it practiced? So now if we understand the force of virus and smallpox, etc., this was one way. The second was, you see which is the being. Now Tantra is all about it. So Tantra saw that, okay, behind illnesses there are certain forces. So what it did? It invoked the deity who was superior to it, whose order they would listen. So Kal, Mahakal, Manasa, must have heard, I don't know, some people have heard about Manasa goddess. She is the goddess who can cure snake bites. She herself is very poisonous. So she has a double nature. And who is she? She is born out of Shiva's anger. But Shiva can control her, because all the snakes, you know. Now this is a science of a different kind, used to be termed as occult science, which we have lost completely. We are recovering it in another way, by studying the forces, etc., you know, behavior, nature, patterns, etc. But this is the, as mother speaks about the flowers, that, you know, these flowers contain a vibration, and with that vibration we can draw certain energies. So it doesn't matter which way we go. Tantra is about the energies and the beings. So tantrics know it. They can actually encircle the titans through this way. They will call Durga, invoke Durga, and she will push the titans away. So this is a whole approach, which was a very developed approach. See, a Vedantic cannot understand. Vedantin will always say ki this is all different approaches to one divine. No, they are realities, facts. And they have a great bearing upon our everyday functioning. So that's why you see the problem was, you have the classical three Vedic texts, which are Rig Ved, Sam Ved, Yajur Ved, right? They deal with knowledge, bhakti and works, roughly. Yajna is basically all about works. Yaj, it comes from that root. But the fourth text, Atharved, which took a long time for everybody to accept that, you know, it is also part of the Vedas, is all about these now, which is called as magic rituals, incantations, means by which you can ward off, you know, evil spirits, etc., etc. It was a whole science. It was also based on the original truth of the gods as forces and powers. But since a Vedantin's idea is to have moksha, he just disregards them completely. Field. He says, why should I study the field? I just want to get out of this zone. So what will you do if you have to get out of, let's say, a city? You are just looking for ways and means, some exit points through which you can, even if you have to get smuggled inside a truck in Corona Kal, you will go. People have gone like that. But if you have to change this place, you need to understand the entire play of forces. That's why in Shurabindo's yoga, it is specifically important to understand the play of forces that weave this universe. So this is about the gods and their functioning. But opposed to them are the titans. This also we hear. How did titans come into existence? It is the same energy which changes into its opposite. And the classical example is white turning into black. So is black an original color? No. There is no color like black. So what is black? It doesn't allow light to escape. So black is when light is withheld inside. Meaning thereby, when we are not aware of the light within. So you see, there are titanic beings are not aware of the God who dwells within them and within the creation. Therefore, they become beings of division. Why do they become beings of division? They live in the surface ego. There is no divine in this creation within, nowhere else. So what is the result of that? And why does this happen? Because consciousness has entered a state of complete self-forgetfulness. So it doesn't know. It has to recover. That's why titans are the first born. First state of evolution is titans. Because it is wandering. It doesn't know who it is. Why it is here. So the only thing they know is the knowledge which can be gained through the senses. This is the first means given for knowledge. So again, the titans, who are the titans? For them, sensory knowledge is the only thing. Therefore, for the titans, body and bodily pleasure is the only thing they know. Classical, if you want to mark out a titan, their life is centered around these things which satisfy the senses. It's beyond it, thought, finer emotions, not there at all. Their life is, so they have gigantic appetites and they want more and more of these things, not higher things. Spiritual aspiration is out of question. So what do? Wherever they see that there is light, they feel a threat. Like black color's existence is under threat if there is anywhere light. Darkness is threatened by the light. So we will see about the fight between the titans and the gods. Now its implications are tremendous. It has nothing to do with any races. Its implications are that there are both individually within us and collectively in groups of humanity forces that encourage division, and equally there are forces that encourage unity and harmony, not by lip service. Their action is very crafty and subtle. It's very difficult to understand the way the asuras work. So one of the classical ways of an asura functioning is to imitate truth. Supposing it is in fashion to speak about, let us say, unity. So what asura will say? He'll say, you know, I have come, I believe in unity. But it is lip service. You can't know because he's imitating something, whereas inside there is a totally different consciousness. So they function with great degree of craftiness and deception. They will use any material. They can spread, just like the gods are cosmic, these forces are also, they have a wide dominion. I think I was sharing this about the recent suicide. This actor who has died. Suicide or murder, whatever it is. Now you see what happens. I have received a couple of mails where people are feeling very depressed suddenly. And they say that we were not his followers. I mean, we know he's an actor. But we are deeply troubled. We feel depressed. Someone has actually expressed suicidal feelings. Now what is happening? This force is trying to take hold of as many people in its fold as possible. So look at the game of deception. Now this will go catch people's head and start turning it. Oh, you know, it may not be suicide, it may be murder. Then the TV channels will pick up. Now it will start spreading its tentacles throughout in many, many ways. And if you get interested and involved beyond a point, unless we know how to disengage ourselves and look at it dispassionately, our minds will get influenced to different degrees. So they work in very devious ways. That's why it's so important. Unless we are strong individualities, then it's a different thing. And that's why individuality is needed. If we are strong individuality, it doesn't matter. Then we know what to filter out, what to receive, allow it to pass through reason or a deeper intuition and know things. But otherwise, the masses are swayed. So why they are fighting? Both wants dominion. If light increases, darkness is under threat. It is also existence. It is a limited existence, very limited. And another typical thing about Titans is the more limited you are, the more insecure you are. See, if you are vast, earth, sky, ocean, does it care what is, you know, even in the ocean you have a nuclear explosion, ocean will have a little tremor and say, oh, it's okay. Vastness of the sky, does it care how many aircrafts are flying, tens of thousands every day? Because it's so vast expanse. But if you do the same thing, the more limited we are. So Titans, this is the other part. Because their existence has come to a point where they are, it's like they feel they are themselves stifled. They want to preserve it against the whole cosmos. So they start thinking everybody is their enemy. Characteristic way of the working of the Asura. He suspects everyone. He cannot trust because he is small. And therefore, what does a person who is very small, he does? He wants to attack you because he wants to be one up. He is seeing an intention into you which may never exist. So, Titans and us gods. You see, some time back, there was this fight over Hindi, some 30, 40 years back. All politically motivated. The average person is really not interested. He's not bothered about these things. But politicians whip up, sentiments. Then people actually started attacking. Even the ashram was attacked. Can you imagine? What for? But they want to destroy anywhere they see a possibility of light. And that's why the ancient times, the yogis were advised not to speak about what's going on inside. See, it was a big safety. I myself learned with great thing that when you speak something, it is now in the hands of the all kinds of forces. What they will do with it is their business. But you do become vulnerable to these forces. They will attack it. Various kinds of ways they will attack it. Hence, the Vedic mystics, as a safeguard, they spoke about these things in a double language, what is called as a parallel language. They said, we are asking for cows and horses. So the titanic beings, oh, cows and horses, it's okay. But they are asking for light and power. Why are they asking light and power? To destroy the titans. Why they want to destroy the titans? Well, by destroying, they can liberate it themselves. They are narrow existence. The only way you can free it is by releasing them of their bonds. They are imprisoned in their prison of smallness, fears, anger, wrath, jealousies. This is what they are imprisoned in. It's a miserable life. If you break it, you feel freedom. So this battle is not like the gods are some coming from one side and the titans are in some outer world, in some geographical region, and they are fighting for dominating the land. They are fighting, but not for dominating the land, but for the human consciousness. Why? Because human consciousness, whoever takes hold, can exercise a great power. There are many things inside the human body. So they fight for the human body. And of course also for masses. Why does God allow this? Because evolution has to be a gradual process. Every time a human soul faces the onslaught of the titans, it grows in strength. Every time the human consciousness faces the sweetness of the gods, it grows in the way of love and unity and harmony. So both of them, through their mutual opposition, help the human consciousness to grow. Because ultimately it is part of one existence. Even the most terrible titan is a limited existence. It is a limited consciousness. It is a limited force. And it is a limited ananda. So you will see in all the ways of the titan, limited existence. So they always feel threatened. And they want to assert. People want to assert. People who will take out their visiting card and keep on the table. You know who I am. I am so and so. Inspector General of Police. I am a famous politician. Be careful. These people are vicious, titanic beings. Because they feel that without this, we will be nobody and nothing. People who throw their weight as this. So you'll see in Titans all this. Always you will see. You know, when Ravana meets Rama, what does he do? He tells him, you know who I am, who I am, who I am. Then first Angad puts him in his place. He says, yes, yes, I know. My dad had once caught you in his tail and taken you around the world. Huh? Is it? Because they can't bear. They are limited existence, very afraid. Like snakes, very afraid. Then he comes and talks to Rama. You know who I am, who I am. Rama listens everything. Then he says, Ravana, we are on battlefield. Shall we have a arrow exchange rather than exchange of words? What, whose identity is will be known through the arrows. So you will see limited existence, limited consciousness. So they do a lot of tapasya to get that they are attracted to the force rather than the knowledge. Even knowledge, a perverse kind of knowledge. They know how to manipulate the small things, because they have a hold over material things. That's why the human body and its intricate mechanisms is where they can easily enter, create physical illnesses. Mother has spoken about it, the adverse forces. Why? Because the body is so unconscious. Wherever there is unconsciousness, they can act very well. Like thieves, they will enter into it. Now, we are not conscious of the body most of the time. That's why physical culture, which helps in the growth of consciousness, can not only, you know, indirectly help us in remaining healthy, but also it makes us aware. So people can become that much aware that if a disease is entering, they will know from a distance. Not only yogis, I have seen people. I have heard about Dr. B.C. Roy, must have heard about, you know, Bidhan Chandra Roy, the famous Calcutta physicians. He could know by a person entering into the office that he's having this illness. And I have seen my own, one of my professors, medicine professors, and I remember taking a case and telling him that, sir, I have brought a case. Okay, let her enter, pregnant lady. And as soon as she enters, he sees, doesn't ask anything, makes her sit, puts the stethoscope, get diagnosed, gone. So I said, how did you know it? He said, she's observation. She's a Nepali woman. I saw from this distance she is pale and she was breathless. He knew that she is having tuberculosis. It was proved. So there are ways that means people could smell an illness. See, the moment we become conscious, the Titan's game is over, because it acts on the basis of unconsciousness. Falsehood, deception. So they will make people speak things which are, you know, today we will... having this, people speak and everybody believes whatever they speak. But there is something else behind the words which one can catch if you are alert. Otherwise, you know, this is what happened. So this is how they operate, falsehood, unconsciousness. Mother has spoken this, no? Suffering, they enjoy suffering. They are suffering. Why they are suffering? The narrower you are, the more miserable your life will be. But instead of becoming vast, they blame it all onto God. You have in the triple soul forces. God has made me to suffer. My life is meant for misery. What can I do? But what is needed is to expand. At every level. Physically, vitally, emotionally, psychologically, intellectually. And when you widen, you don't suffer. Because nothing really. Then you see that this was a net in which I was caught. So this is how the titans and the gods operate. And they fight with... Gods want human beings to enter into a state of light, vastness, beauty, delight, harmony. And titans want human beings to remain in their fold. And human beings, mother says, readily choose the Titan. Limited existence, limited consciousness, limited force. So whom do the Titans pray very easily? Shiva. Why? Not the benevolent Shiva. Rudra, they know. Shiva has power. And he can just give away like that. Because he is also Ashutosh. Vishnu is cunning. Balance of dharma. I cannot fool Vishnu. He is consciousness. Shiva is like, you know, you pray to him. Shiva is force incarnate. Titans are themselves, you know, having some, but their force is crude. It's more like the physical brute force. Whereas the gods have intelligence, the subtle force. They have love, the subtle energies. Whereas Titans have crude, vital and physical force. So they want force and they don't have Ananda. So they are always complaining, grumbling, angry. So what do they do for Ananda? Drinks and smoke. Limited pleasure, sense pleasures. Because that's the only way they can experience some semblance of delight. So now we see that the battle of the Titans and the gods is relevant to us. It is through that that we evolve. And both must work. First the Titans come. Because matter is so hard. You need a brute force to really wake up matter. So the Titans are the firstborn, the elders. The gods come later. So Titans will work upon matter and hard block and they will build something out of it. Then the gods will come. Okay, we'll light a lamp, we'll, you know, put some flowers. So Titans feel very cheated. This is not done. But it's a function, cosmic function. They can become gods if they want. But they start snatching because gods get all the credit. Most of the time when you go to a temple, oh, so beautifully decorated, no flowers. Says, but appreciate sometimes the block of stones also which are on the sides, you know. So Titan's work is on crude material which is not yet ready for the gods. So Titans are the first ones. Then you have the gods who come later on. So all human beings start from this phase of being asuric. Asura and gods, as Sri Aurobindo describes in the Gita, we should not think that some are gods and some are asuras. Man, because he emerges out of inconscient, he is born as an asura. It is by being twice born, that's why they call dwij. Born into the spirit that we convert into becoming a god. And what is the way to change from a titan into a god? Twice born is aspiration. Without spiritual aspiration, we are titans. We may be nice titans. Bali was a very nice person. Titans are not like bad, but they are living in that circle of ignorance. That's why Bali is such a nice person. Yet he wants to conquer heaven. Yet he wants to, you know, extend his empire because that's how a limited consciousness operates. But gods know, so they don't want to possess something. So we start with a state of asura, division, unconsciousness, falsehood, suffering, etc. But by aspiration, which is the turning point, we become twice born. We change into a godlike humanity. And this is the working that goes on inside every human being. And that process is beautifully described in the story of Sagar Manthan. Story. So what is the story? What is that ocean? Ocean is the cosmic force. Now it is happening at collective level. The same applies at individual level. So out of the cosmic force, the churning has to start. So within us also, something of that force is there, that cosmic consciousness. Now the churning starts. Various kind of things come. And they are given respectively the Titans and the gods. Not going into the details of the story because each aspect that comes out is very fascinating. It has a meaning. Whether it be the seven tusked elephant called Airavat, white elephant, or it is the flying horse Uchheshravas, or it is Kaustubh Mani, Lakshmiji, Dhanvantri himself. All these are different kinds of aspects and powers. But before we become a claimant of immortality, we have two tests. The first is Kalkut, poison. The whole poison which is hidden inside the human consciousness, which we don't see. because it is released in bits and parts. Suddenly it emerges and the person can be in the grip of this because it's Kalkut, it's coming from the depth and is spreading all over. And after we have negotiated with the poison, only Shiva can bear it. If we have rooted in the eternal, then it will go through that phase. The next step is, after the poison, there is another test. People often say, after Kalkut, Amrit comes. Yes, it comes. But God puts it on hold. This is a command, put on hold. So Amrit has emerged. You see it, but you can't get it. Oh, there it is. But you can't get it. No, no, one more test. What is that test? Vishwamohini. He becomes Vishwamohini. Wait, wait, wait. You really want Amrit? I can give you all the joys of the world. That's Vishwamohini. I can give you power, prestige, honor, everything I can give you. Do you want this or that? The Titan says, okay, Amrit I can take later on. Right now my ambition is more important. And the gods say, nothing to do with the ego. Our eyes are on immortality. Then the beauty is you get that nectar and you also get everything else. That is the strange part. You get the nectar and you get the company of the gods. So Vishnu's reward stands. Why does it stand? You have to sacrifice the ego. See, the asuras start fighting and there is that all that sangram which takes place. They run away actually. They snatch away the Amrit by force and take it. So Vishnu does a plan and he becomes Vishwamohini and they easily give it to her. And so it's a symbolic story at every level. So again, Rahu and Ketu, one part changes, but the other part doesn't get converted. All these are deeply yogic symbols. Those who undertake yoga, they know it. And this is not a one-time process. It's a constant process, constant churning, till ultimately we become adhikari of Amrit. And then we drink it and, you know, the nectar of immortality, bliss, ananda. So this is the whole process which is described in Secret of the Vedas. Shobindu describes at great length about these titans and gods and their psychological functions. And each of the gods, who is Agni, Maruts, Indra, Parjanya, Varuna, Usha, all the feminine and the masculine gods, and it's in great detail, and the titans. So I'm reading only one passage. So I had already seen that the central idea of the Vedic rishis was the transition of the human soul from a state of death to a state of immortality. Now this immortality is not physical immortality. That's the titan's way. Straight away he wants physical immortality. Physical immortality is the crown, ultimate. When the body is completely free of the titan's influence, meaning thereby when there is no possibility of error in the body, falsehood, there is no possibility of unconsciousness, each cell is conscious, when there is no possibility of suffering in the body, it's nothing but delight, when there is not a corner of darkness in the body, then it will be freed from death. It will be one day. But the process starts from within. The first consciousness of first immortality is to discover that part in us which is immortal, the divine element. So he speaks of that. To a state of immortality by the exchange of the falsehood for the truth, anritam for rith. Of divided and limited being for integrality and infinity. Means all our limited identities, we have to change it for our infinite identity. Somebody was asking, who is child? What is the meaning of child of the divine? It's in this kind, child of the divine, okay? What is the child of the divine? What is his identity? When we are children, we are identified with the parents. Isn't it? Who are you? I'm a child of the divine identity. And it's honest, not like, you know, for the sake of saying, hum to ji Ram ji ke bhakt hain. It's not like that. It's, you can't trick God, fool him. Child of the divine. Child is full of wonder. Child is plastic to everything, open to the whole creation. Child doesn't carry all these ego structures, this is good, this is bad, I cannot trust this, child is open like that, open, full of wonder, plasticity. That's why children grow very fast, full of aspiration. Look at a child, Children are aspiring, I want to become like that uncle. Unfortunately, aspiring for the wrong fellows. I want to be like my dad. By the time he becomes like his dad, he says, sorry, I got a wrong model. That's why in ancient times, we had ideals for which children can aspire. It's very unfortunate that in this age, children don't have. Who are the ideals? Sachin Tendulkar. Or one of the Khan brothers. Whatever. Because we don't have ideals. But even we grew up with those Mahabharata and Ramayana. At least I grew up like that. Oh, one should be like Arjuna. What a tremendous Bhishma's pratigya. Steadfast. How much you will be able to reach that, but at least you have something worth striving for. Now we have nothing worth striving for. So, this is the journey of man from a state of division to infinity. By exchanging it. Now how do we exchange? Exchange, look at the word. We give this and get that. Whom do we give? We give to the divine. Both are his own, like the obverse and the reverse side. So you give to the divine this old currency, titanic currency. Divine keeps for some time, sees it, puts it into fire, purifies it, then gives us back the new. This was the exchange, the yagna of divided and limited being for integrality and infinity. Death is the mortal state of matter with mind and life involved in it. Immortality is a state of infinite being, consciousness and bliss. When we are identified with infinity, there is no death. Man rises beyond the two firmaments, heaven and earth, mind and body, to the infinity of the truth, mahas, and so to the divine bliss. This is the great passage discovered by the ancestors, the ancient rishis. So we have to go beyond the titan and the gods. But first from the titanic state to the gods. But don't stop at the gods. You have to go beyond this duality. Then we discover that truth which is infinite. Now he describes, the gods I found to be described as children of light. Sons of Aditi. So who is Aditi? Aditi. So very often in Vedas and ancient language we find this. Yesterday we were talking about Anritam, Adharma, Anarya. So we have Aditi. Diti is division. So Aditi is undivided, infinite. Of infinity. And without exception they are described as increasing man. How to make out a god like being from a titanic being? Here it goes. What do they do? Bringing him light. Pouring on him the fullness of the waters. The waters which cleanse away all that is dark and all that is sordid, ugly. What is the titan? Oh, you are an ugly person. You are a fallen being. What is the gods? Arise, O resplendent one. Thou art the divine. This is the way gods function. Because they see that. But titanic beings, even when God is standing in front of them, they will say, you are a trickster. You have two eyes like us. You are like us. Another us. I am the one. I have the knowledge I can give you. But the godlike beings, they are givers of light and fullness of the waters. The abundance of the heavens. Increasing the truth in him. So they increase the inner wealth. And what is this inner wealth? Titans are after outer wealth because that's the only thing they understand. Inner wealth is all these qualities. Beauty, harmony, sweetness, delight, strength, wisdom, peace, tranquility. All this is the inner wealth, wideness. So this is what the gods give. Hope. Building up the divine worlds. Leading him against all attacks to the great goal. And what is that great goal? The integral felicity, a state of joy. God stay in a state of natural felicity. The perfect bliss. Whereas the titans are all the time in a state of unhappiness. And it's nobody else but their own state of smallness which is causing unhappiness. Their separate functions emerged by means of their activities. Their epithets. So you had the god of bliss, delight, soma. Now you see again very interesting. Soma identified with the moon. Soma, mystic delight. Soma, the wine. What? Why do people take wine? Because of it gives them a little high. They are high on pleasure. It's obviously degradation. But you can look at it, look at the correspondence. So, intoxicated with delight, we use the word. He is intoxicated with bliss. Sri Aurobindo uses the term, my words are drunk with the immortal's wine. Soma. So this is Soma. Now, the Rishi is because they didn't want people to know they have Ananda. So what they would say is Soma. We are asking for Soma. So Titan said, oh, they are drinking. They said, okay, you think we are drinking. We are drinking something else. So they understand like that Shiva is taking something which makes him high. It's because the Titan cannot understand the subtlety. Titan can never understand that there can be an inner bliss, inner felicity. He can only understand something which is concrete to the senses, outer, which he can hold to. So, the bliss. The indications, the psychological sense of the legends connected with them, the indications of the Upanishads and Puranas, the occasional sidelights from Greek myth. On the other hand, the demons who oppose them are all powers of division and limitation. So how do they act? Coverers, they cover the truth. So we don't know that there is truth inside us. We don't know there is delight inside us. So we catch something, please give me some joy. Why? Because they have covered. Even in the other person they cover. So they cover this truth. They are coverers. Look at this. They cover the truth. They cover the bliss. They cover everything that is beautiful. And therefore they create a facade of only that which is hideous and ugly. Coverers. Tearers. The divide. Tear away, snatch, devourers. So what they do is that, you know, we have a very beautiful state. You are feeling so happy, you have come out of the ashram. And then you tell somebody, you know, I am feeling so happy. Now the devourer. Acha, by the way, you remember? Now what happened after 5 minutes, all that is gone. Worse is if you tell somebody, I have actually seen it. By mistake, mention to someone. You know, you do it in spite of everything. You are off guard. You take it, you know, sometimes you just... And share that, you know, I had been to mother's room. Something started within 3-4 minutes. And the whole atmosphere was so different, you know, from that bliss. Now, because I was conscious of what's happening. So, I held on to that insight that this is a clear-cut attack. But it could have been avoided. This is how they function. That's why it is said, safeguard it. These things are treasures, secret treasures. Don't talk about them to anyone and everyone because you will become vulnerable. The forces will attack us. Devourers, confiners, they will not let you move. You are marching very beautifully on the path of evolution. They will put one obstacle after another. They will not let you go beyond. And that's how the mother says, every time you have to make a progress, you have to pass through examinations. And the greater the intended progress, the greater the examination. So what is the secret? How to pass? So I can share that little trick that I have. So one is, oh my God. Once again, then you shrink back, you fight, all this. Yeah, you can do that. But if you look at what Sri Aurobindo and the mother says, turn it towards oneness. What was that oneness? When Anusuya was tested by the gods, what did she say? Yes, come in. I will enter into another state of consciousness. Now this oneness, which we find several places, Prahlad, oneness. Hiranyakashipu, what is, I am going to kill you, it's okay. But my Hari is everywhere. If he has to protect me, he'll protect me. Is he even in this pole? Yes, he's there. If we live in a state of oneness and make it a practice to see the divine everywhere and in everything, then you are safe. This is the ultimate practice. Mother speaks of it. She speaks of it in the agenda based on that, you know, one of the, in her own entourage, there were people who were hostile. Sri Aurobindo speaks of it that, you know, some hostile beings were, they had kept close to them. So one of them was this girl, whose name was then Chinmayi. And she used to get impulses to push mother. And mother had kept her near. So once, only once, to drive away that being which was capturing her, the mother had slightly been strong to her, firm. And Sri Aurobindo saw. He didn't say anything that time. But he said only one remark. And mother observes this. He says, he said, you ought not have done that. Then mother remarks, because Sri Aurobindo did not much, you know, he has written letters on hostile beings and all, so that we know how they function. But in action, he always insisted on oneness. Behind every facade, there is the one. And if you keep remembering, reorienting, everything, keep referring to the one. Everything, even if you are in the worst of situations, refer to the one. Open to the mother. And this is the way of the great mystics. You know, when Guru Nanak was caught along with his disciple Banda in the jail, Mughals had put him, and he asked him, you are a man of God, why you are in this state? He said, never question the divine, trust him, you don't know what is his play. Look at now the irony of things. The early Mughal emperor captures Guru Nanak, though he is released next day. Whatever happened. But ultimately the entire Mughal empire is demolished by Guru Gobind Singh, who is the last Guru, and Shivaji. It's amazing. So, because one sees oneness, but what do? Confiners. They will not let you move. But the day you see that this too is divine and do this naman, this is one of the paths. I am not saying that everybody should follow it or can follow it. This is how I have understood life, and it works wonderfully if you do it sincerely. But it must be practiced thoroughly with all the faith. Dualizers, they divide things into good and bad, right, wrong. They have this tendency. Dualizers, obstructors, as their names indicate. So all of them have their names. Powers that work against the free and unified integrality of the being. So what do? Divide. Northern India, Southern India, Aryan, Dravidian. They'll divide on the basis of language, caste, creed, color, all of these things. But integrality doesn't mean blurring the distinction. You'll see it as one continuum. So when somebody asks you next time, do you belong to North India or South India? Say, India is enough. Both of us are Indians. What is there, North India? Okay, Northerners, you may say, you want to say, it's okay. But India is the important. Emphasis should be on India. You see the difference. Emphasis on North or South, or emphasis on India. India is the common uniting factor. The other is dividing factor. It's just a little twist, little change, and it changes everything. So this is how they work. By a wrong emphasis on things. Whereas in integrality, you see everything on a single continuum. These vritras who divide, panis who cover, atris, rakshasas who devour, sambara, vala, namuchi are not Dravidian kings and gods, Shubhendra reminds us. As the modern mind with its exaggerated historic sense would like them to be. They represent a more antique idea. In fact, where was that time, you know, all this, these differences. Suited to the religious and ethical preoccupations of our forefathers. They represent the struggle between the powers of the higher good and the lower desire. Anything, even you may be a very religious person and everything, you may profess wonderful things, knowledge, all the great powers, but for satisfaction of desire and ego, gone. It is the play of the titan. But even the worst things done as an offering to the divine, remembering the divine, not for any pleasure, any satisfaction of ego or desire, can become a path. Now, this is a ultimate possibility. They represent the struggle between the powers of the higher good and the lower desire. And this conception of the Rig Veda and the same opposition of good and evil, otherwise expressed with less psychological subtlety, with more ethical directness in the scriptures of the Zoroastrians, our ancient neighbors and kindred, proceeded probably from a common original discipline of the Aryan culture. So, initially it was very subtle. They are states of consciousness. There are beings who relate to that state of consciousness. But later on it became actual gods and titans challenging each other, fighting with each other. When Indra becomes too ambitious, what happens to Indra? He falls. He becomes a very ordinary person. Equally, when the titans, when they are leading a life like King Bali, he conquers the heaven. It is through the state of consciousness that we become either a titan, which is a very limited state, where falsehood, suffering, unconsciousness, untruth, darkness, allegiance to death, they prevail. The opposite, unity, harmony, beauty, sweetness, delight, knowledge, wideness, calm, these are the states of the gods. We can use them as names, but equally we can invoke them as forces. Modern mind is more keen on forces. So we can invoke peace. We can invoke wideness. Varuna understands that I am being called. Varuna is the god of vastness. That's why he is described as somebody you can see even in the dark. Because he's vast. Nothing misses his vision. In the Greeks, there would be Apollonians and Dionysians. Soma. You may invoke the deity Soma through various rituals, or you may say, may the delight in my being increase, may felicity increase, may joy increase, may hope increase. So this is the path which has been shown to us, the titans and the gods, and man must move away from his allegiance to the asuric nature and asuric temperament towards the nature of the gods and temperament of the gods. This is his first step. Next, he will integrate the two. As Shurvinda says in Durga Strot, give me the strength of the titans, the character and intelligence of the gods. That is the next step. But first, he must leave behind the asura and take on the godlike nature, as the Gita says. And what that nature is, beautifully described in the Gita in chapter 16. Then very elaborate description of Devasuri Sampada. We can write it and put it in our house that these are the qualities I must inculcate. Also the 12 qualities of the mother. So to grow in the way of the God, this is another for reference, those who want to read. This is a very beautiful essay of Sri Aurobindo, The Superman, where he describes who are the titans and who are the gods. So gods are those who increase always within us vastness, light, strength. They have strength, but their strength is based on light. They will never deviate from that. It will be based on dharma, not adharma. Not dharma, dharma as we understand a moral right or wrong. But something much more subtle, something much more profound. So this is the path of the gods. And on contrast, there are the titans. So let us be freed from the clutch of the titans and grow in our godlike nature, which is what man is intended to be. Namaste.